The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Right now, there's a pilot program underway in the city of Seattle. And if it's successful, could potentially change policing, not just in Seattle, but really all around the region. It's a dual dispatch where members of the CARE team, stands for Community Assisted Response and Engagement, they help officers handle the nonviolent cases where someone is dealing with some kind of crisis, persons in crisis. We're talking about, in a lot of cases, though not always, folks who are homeless, folks who are dealing with a mental health crisis. And it could go in a way that gets embraced in a much bigger way. Certainly that's what they're hoping for over at the CARE team, which is run by Chief Amy Smith, who joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So generally speaking, when we're talking about someone in crisis, especially in the context of the pilot program, for the most part, it sounds like we're dealing with, potentially dealing with people who are either homeless and or dealing with some mental health issues.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the most common calls for service.
So take us through how the program works specifically.
Yeah, so the CARE team responders are on police channels, listening to the same radio. And when calls come in to 911, which I also have oversight of, if they are screened to be low priority, low acuity, so priority 3 or 4, we know somebody needs help, somebody needs some risk. You know, we see folks wandering through traffic, muttering sometimes, or crying, or in some kind of distress that doesn't look like it's overdose. We don't see any weapons, any concern about violence. Then the team is dispatched downtown. So it's between 11 a.m. to 2300, 11 p.m. But they're dispatched at the same time as police. And so generally, police show up. They can be there for just a minute. You know, it basically is the police co-response model, but I've got two different vehicles so that police can say, are you good here? You know, clear the scene, and then they move on to another call. So my primary objective is to get cops to high acuity calls. I've got to get folks out to priority one within 7 minutes. Right now, I can't do it. There's just too many calls for service.
And that's obviously been an issue that has plagued this department and really just the city for several years.
Yeah.
Obviously started around COVID and really had to do with, I think, the BLM movement kind of pushed cops out. And the staffing situation,
right,
especially amongst patrol officers, we have the HR numbers we went over last week. I mean, you're just talking about a little over 430 patrol officers who can work, and obviously they're not all working at the same time. So I had the opportunity to do a ride along with the CARE team a few weeks back just to see generally how it worked. And one thing that seems to be clear, and it's a potential issue certainly in the short term, is an officer, it sounds like, has to ask for a CARE team member to come out to a call, correct?
Well, they can be dispatched at the same time, or they can go in secondary response mode, which is when the officer is requesting. So it just kind of depends on availability. And we're still figuring out the screening process. Mm-hmm. You know, in dispatch, I mean, they were part of SPD. And so it is a novel concept for folks inside the system to think about having another resource that's, you know, a master's level behavioral health specialist. All of my folks have already worked in crisis response for years. You know, two were CSOs. But that's part of it, getting buy-in and dispatch to know, no, we're being very cautious about this. You know, it is very valid, I think, the fear of sending unarmed responders to calls right now. That's a valid fear. I know there's a lot of fear, you know, inside the fire department as well, because the effects, the side effects of fentanyl are unprecedented. It is different out there right now. And so I'm always very quick to acknowledge that. So, yeah, sometimes we're just dispatching primarily, you know, the CARE team goes out, but then very often we're not getting the protocols right. I'm sending cops to a call. They get there. They're like, this is not for us. Mm-hmm. We do not need to be here. And they'll call on CARE, or they'll call on a community service officer, a CSO. There's wild overlap. I mean, both units can do a lot of the same types of work.
I got the impression that officers were not yet really utilizing the services to the extent, I think, that the department would hope for. Is that still a general case?
Yeah, I think it's actually not being used to the extent that police command hope for.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm feeling I'm a little bit more patient with the rollout because I know it is a new concept and we're trying things out. We're figuring out, it's almost like choreography, you know, how best to do this. Are there calls that care should just go to, especially for high utilizers? We already know someone. But there's a lot of urgency in police command. I hear Chief Diaz, Chief Barden, Chief Maxey, lots of people saying, you need to use this resource. You know, it's here now. They're good. They know what they're doing. Use it. And we're also working to make sure that we articulate the role of the community service officers and just other resources we have in the system. You know, I'm talking a lot to people who are in outreach work, who are in diversion, to figure out, can I have lots of different co-response type models? Mm-hmm. You know, can I just contract with different teams who have different types of specialization, either go out with officers or with the care team?
It does seem, though, that officers, especially the ones I talk to, seem reluctant to call care over. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the same general concern of that anyone might have of sending someone who's unarmed to a potentially volatile situation.
Yeah.
I mean, even when you've got a general sense that things are not going to get violent, there's no guarantee of that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's interesting because I get often, I don't hear that resistance, but it's because people aren't going to say it to me.
Yeah, they won't tell you.
Really,
they'll tell me.
Yeah, when officers are seeking me out. Yeah, exactly. And I totally accept that. So it's been fun to get around to roll calls, and I'm always level setting that I understand how my department was organized. I understand that this pilot was framed to be antagonistic toward cops. I just got here a year ago. I do not see it that way at all. And I think I'm uniquely poised to comment, you know, on the work of officers. I'm in 911. I am watching and listening and observing around the clock. And so I think that's part of it. You know, I'm just wrapping up a year, and I think people are starting to believe that I absolutely mean what I'm saying. I am convinced that this is the right philosophy to design with police and with fire. And I feel like if we had just set up a third department, like in the 60s, when we started seeing a lot of mental health crisis, you know, we started seeing more PTSD, more dependency, you know, the domestic disputes that were nonviolent in nature. Like, what if we just started sending social workers then? I think that would have been such a better approach, which would have reduced this burden that was always on officers, you know, to respond to virtually every single concern in community. Like, that is just an irrational design. It would be horrible for any human to feel like they had to have every single skill from every profession. And that's basically how it's been.
We're talking with Chief Amy Smith. In addition to running, overseeing the department for 911 calls, she's overseeing this new pilot program. It's a dual dispatch program where members of a non-police team go out into the field dealing with some folks who are dealing with a crisis. Right now, there's some significant limitations because it's part of a pilot program. And as I was thinking about writing through my experiences when I was on this ride-along, there was one point that just kept coming in my head, which was, in a lot of ways, it feels like because of the amount of rules that are involved, and even though I totally understand it, it's almost like it was designed to fail in that, you know what I mean? Like, there has to be some level of, I don't know if aggression is the right word, but, you know, it got to be proactive. And, you know, seeing that you can't proactively approach someone who's homeless and in the streets and clearly is in need of, you know, some kind of intervention outside of obviously an emergency where someone's getting an overdose, needs Narcan. But outside of that, just walking by and being present is important, but not being able to be proactive is a bit of a head scratcher to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I was pretty naive coming in. I've never been around bureaucracy at all. You know, I've been at these generally smaller, mid-sized, very nimble nonprofits where as fast as you can get the funding and have a proper philosophy and academic premise, you go to work, you know, and we have to design in a way, like, I don't know what this team can or should do until I get out there and start trying things and see where the need is. And so I've realized, you know, that, and I think it's not just Seattle government, I think it's everywhere. It's like we want to sit in a boardroom and design a perfect thing, but that's not how it works. And as fast as we figure one thing out, we're seeing it right now with fentanyl, right? We hadn't even figured out meth at all. and then fentanyl came online, and we didn't, like in supportive housing and some of these environments, we didn't contemplate a smoked drug, basically. You know, we really didn't. We weren't prepared for that. And now I'm seeing, you know, now we've got trank, and we don't know how to respond to that. And so I do feel urgency around, you know, acting and designing, being really transparent about what appears to be working and what's not working. And to your point, yeah, you cannot stipulate, you know, every single tiny minute detail of a pilot that's intended to respond to crisis, because every situation is different. And it took me a few months to realize call types don't even matter, actually. They really don't. They're premised on what somebody's observing, mm-hmm. what they're guessing. And what's really interesting from a research perspective is what did it turn out to be, right? Yeah. What did we think it was? We are typing things incorrectly all the time. And in 911, you know, last year there was over 5,500 person down two priority types and fewer than 200, I think, priority three down types. And I just knew, because I walk around downtown, that is not right. That is not right. That is presuming all of these folks who are napping and muttering and, you know, that they're all violent. No, they're not. But it made a lot of sense to me that in 911, they're making things too so that somebody will go, because I don't have enough officers. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so it's like, and I think it also brings up two important points here. Number one, you know, to a certain degree, you're not really ever going to fix a poorly observed 911 call, right? I mean, if I'm calling 911, right. It's not because I'm, you know, trained to look for certain things. It's just what I think I see in the moment. But number two, you know, you're also dealing with the fact that it's also true that just because we think something might be priority three or priority four doesn't mean it actually is priority three or priority four. And you know this, have one screw up in which one of your care team members gets harmed or worse, then the entire program is going to be called out and probably go away.
Yep. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, we see that precedent everywhere, and I'm always trying to level set and be very candid. Anyone could be hurt. Anyone could be shot. I mean, kind of in this country, but certainly in the city right now. We have first responders who are harmed all the time, and it is tragic, and we do everything we can to design against that. But this happens, again, I'm from a social work background and, you know, I've been in a lot of environments that were fraught, and I still am. You know, I'm basically looking at crime and crisis hotspots, and I'm hanging out there to try to understand what's happening. I assume a level of risk to do the work that I'm doing. I try to manage that risk, but the proper response is just to train people to be nimble, to be improvisational, to really understand, like, when you have a new drug come online, how does that show up? I feel a lot less safe now than I did 10 years ago. Because I can see by the data, behaviors are way more erratic, and it's a lot more random, you know, what we're seeing. It used to be, I hear people often talk about, you know, folks who are unsheltered, and they weren't seen to be a threat generally, right? You grew up and you were used to seeing the same few people hanging out in an area, and it was largely just benign, sad perhaps, but not something that we were scared of. And so things are different right now. Jason, at the end of the day, I care so much about people. I really do. I care about all the people. I know I've got to get folks indoors. People should not be dying on the streets. They shouldn't be smoking fentanyl on the corner and overdosing. And I can see it's going to happen again tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Mm-hmm. It cannot be like this, you know, and I do know I've got to do something to support law enforcement right now. I liked when you published those patrol numbers, because I knew that.
Yep.
But I don't think people understand what we've actually done. And when I am sitting in 911, the scarcity, just seeing it on the monitor, it's really upsetting, really problematic.
Last question for you, and maybe this is a little in the weeds, so don't give me an in the weeds answer, because otherwise people will tune out. But do you think that if the 911 call center was not removed from SPD, this would go a little bit differently in at least being accepted by cops, because you are now a third party, essentially, and it was kind of removed in a very political way. I think there's no doubt about that. It was very clearly politically motivated. And so, you know, you might just not be seen as part of the team, and whether or not that's fair doesn't really matter if that's the perception. So what do you think the roles would look like? We have about a minute left. If you were back in with SPD, under SPD leadership?
Yeah, I think in the short run, it would have been easier. There's no question. I think in the long run, I am so useful to SPD, I think, and to fire too, because I am outside the system commenting objectively, empirically on the system and what's needed. You know, and I think having that voice impartially, you know, and objectively just talking about the problems and potential solutions, it's really powerful. You know, that's been one of the most meaningful parts of last year, was being able to go to roll calls to say, I acknowledge this, I see this. you know, and also the community does too. I'm in tons of community meetings surfacing what it is that we're actually seeing, whether it's about, you know, fentanyl or it's about housing or people don't understand, you know, being arrested, that doesn't mean being booked, right?
Correct.
And outpatient treatment won't work for this thing. And, you know, juveniles, nope, you have to be caught with a firearm five times. You know, there's a lot of different things that people just don't understand. And so I think we got a little bit lucky that I have the temperament that I do and I am who I am, because I think if you had a different leader come in that was very antagonistic toward the system, boy, I think it would have been a mess.
No kidding. And you leak something unintentionally, not leak necessarily, but people don't realize that juveniles have to get caught basically five times with a gun before it even registers within the city and county.
I had to fact check that. Yeah. Like, I could not believe that. And that's, again, at a state level that needs to change. But you could do a story about that for sure.
Oh, yes. Well, believe me, that story is in my draft box right now. We've been talking with Chief Amy Smith. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And obviously, we're going to be keeping an eye on this and see how it develops over the next several months.
Yeah, thanks for the good questions and interest.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we're going to dive into some quick hits.